welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It's Thursday, May 16. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette today, better access seen with new behavioral care law. This story by Tom Barton for the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law Wednesday a plan to streamline and combine Iowa's delivery system for mental and behavioral health services, which advocates hope will improve access for patients. Far too long, and for too many Iowans in need of help, navigating and accessing services across the system has been too difficult for patients and providers alike, Reynolds said. While Iowa's mental health regions are funded by the state, they're not aligned with the substance use disorder system, even though more than 25% of adults with serious mental health challenges also suffer from substance abuse, the governor said. The result, Reynolds said, has led to duplicative and inconsistent programs, an inefficient system, and poor outcomes. And we can do better for Iowans in need, and we are. We will, she said. By bringing services together in this way, we will enable better coordination of care, supporting the best possible outcomes for each individual. It's what Iowans deserve, and it's what we intend to deliver. The new law combines Iowa's total of 32 mental health and substance use regions into 7 unified behavioral health districts, while placing disability services under the jurisdiction of the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services. The proposal aims to improve a system that both state officials and advocates agree is badly fractured. Each district will be required to provide a standard set of core services, ensuring consistent care system-wide, Reynolds said. The Department of Health and Human Services will define district boundaries and required services, implement performance metrics, and provide oversight of the system. The districts would handle prevention, education, early intervention, treatment, recovery, and crisis services related to mental health and substance use disorders. Funding for those services would also be merged into one behavioral health fund overseen by Iowa HHS. For the first time, we will have an intentionally planned system that includes, in statute, prevention, treatment, and recovery, said Kelly Garcia, Director of Health and Human Services. Each district would be overseen by an advisory board of local providers and government officials to identify opportunities, address challenges, and advise the Administrative Services Organization. The governor signed the bill, House File 2673, at Foundation 2 Crisis Services, and toured the nonprofit's new headquarters after a $5.4 million renovation of the Whitwer Building in downtown Cedar Rapids. The organization operates a 24/7 crisis support line, emergency youth shelter, crisis mental health support, and other services. Emily Blum, executive officer of Foundation 2, said the merger of the two regions is a step in the right direction to ensure every Iowan has access to comprehensive mental health and substance use support. This legislation is an opportunity to make meaningful changes in the system, which translates to meaningful changes in the lives of Iowans, Blum said, by helping them achieve stability and remain mentally well. The legislation states the new behavioral health services system shall provide equitable statewide access to all services and offer specialized services with a focus on at-risk populations. That includes children, young adults, individuals with disabilities, pregnant women, older Iowans, and those with limited access to financial resources. The bill passed the Iowa legislature with large bipartisan support and was backed by the Iowa Hospital Association, Iowa Mental Health Advocacy, National Alliance on Mental Illness, Coalition for Family and Children Services in Iowa, and others. Some, though, worry the proposal does not go far enough to address underlying issues that hinder access to treatment and services, including Iowa Medicaid reimbursement. While the change could be a win for how Iowa mental health and substance use services are administered, advocates say underlying gaps in care persist. Rural Iowans often face long drives to seek treatment or struggle to access telehealth in sparsely populated areas, where internet connections are weak. Children can't use Iowa's access centers, like those in Linn and Johnson counties, and there's a limited supply of crisis beds and shelter space. Garcia said the Health and Human Services Department is considering building a pipeline for providers and brick-and-mortar spaces to handle complex behavioral health needs, including launching certified community behavioral health clinics. She also emphasized the importance of a comprehensive approach to addressing social issues, recognizing that a single solution will not be sufficient. And so the concept here is that we have a true statewide planning effort, Garcia told reporters after the signing. What's next? The state would contract with local organizations to carry out the services in each of the new 7 behavioral health districts. The state would solicit proposals from existing agencies that oversee mental health regions or other public or nonprofit entity in the district to administer the regions. The law specifies the districts be created by August 1st and organizations selected by December 31st to administer services. The bill specifies the state's transition to a unified behavioral health system be completed by July 1, 2025. A state timeline calls for initial implementation in summer 2025 and full implementation by July 2026. Garcia said the department plans to conduct public forums and community listening sessions over the summer to provide more details, take questions, and gather feedback. The law also moves disability services provided by the state's Mental Health and Disability Service Network to the state's Department of Health and Human Services Division of Aging and Disability Services. It will set up a system with clear access points for Iowans with disabilities, Reynolds said. Garcia said that work will center on enhancing aging and disability resource centers, developing a comprehensive and connected system to address long-term care options for Iowans with disabilities, and building coalitions for aging and disability resources. We're planning to build on existing infrastructure, and we will build truly accessible, one-stop-shop locations for individuals with physical disabilities, Garcia said. We plan for a co-location with our ADRC partners, our Area Agencies on Aging, our Centers for Independent Living, community action agencies, and the like. We have an opportunity to invest in capacity, establishing a higher level of care and specialized care, which is needed now more than ever. This is a monumental shift and a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. As with behavioral health, the goal is to eliminate duplication and provide more focused, coordinated support for Iowans with disabilities. While Iowa's mental health regions also provide disability services, it's maybe a lowercase d, Garcia said. It's not the full focus, and that's because the call to action of the day is behavioral health, she said, and so we don't want our Iowans with disabilities to get a back seat in that ride. And so we have the opportunity, through our own state agency alignment, to think about a strengthened way of providing services, still in a very clear partnership with the behavioral health side, because a lot of individuals, especially with intellectual and developmental disabilities, also have a co-occurring mental health need. Also on the front page, this story by Marissa Payne. Which grocery store could replace Cedar Rapids Hy-Vee? A grocery study the City of Cedar Rapids commissioned last summer found there is high opportunity in the core of the city around the New Bohemia District, the Med Quarter, and downtown for a grocery store that appeals to lower and moderate income residents who are more price conscious when they shop. As city officials work to fill the gap of Hy-Vee's closing of its 1556 First Avenue Northeast store, they say this study will be a tool used to help find another grocer to locate in the area and serve Wellington Heights and Mound View residents. Hy-Vee will leave the core neighborhoods without a grocery store and pharmacy when it closes June 23rd. The study indicated opportunity to recruit a price impact format store, which would be a warehouse format facility focused on offering low prices with no fills interior with limited service departments, such as a deli or bakery. Examples of such stores are Aldi, Price Chopper, Walmart Neighborhood Market, and Walmart Supercenter. According to the study prepared by Sightseer Technologies, smaller, limited assortment stores locate where they can find space that is most affordable. Larger ones need a second-use facility or site large enough for their desired footprint. The study states they also prefer a large parking space and to be a standalone store with retail or restaurant pads. Most price-impact stores prefer to locate in areas with low- and middle-income residents who are price-conscious, the study found. Walmart can locate in a variety of locations because they are large enough to drive their own traffic and not reliant on existing traffic generators. These limited assortment stores appeal to shoppers who are often older, either on fixed incomes, retirees, or middle-class empty nesters. They draw single parents and small working-class families. Shoppers are more likely to be blue-collar workers and high school graduates, with some having earned bachelor's degrees or studied the trades. The study was completed in September, before Hy-Vee announced it would close its First Avenue location. It opened in 2002 after Cedar Rapids dedicated a $915,000 incentive package to replace a small run-down Hy-Vee store nearby. Last November, Cedar Rapids officials were assured that Hy-Vee had extended the lease of its First Avenue Northeast store another 5 years. 6 months later, the company announced the store's closure. A Hy-Vee spokesperson did not answer a question about whether its lease agreement with the property owner includes a non-compete clause that would hinder the city from recruiting another grocer here. With more than 4 years left on the lease, Hy-Vee also has said, not said, whether it plans to terminate its lease or hold the property for the remainder of the lease, as it has with its former Collins Road Northeast store. But spokesperson Tina Potoff said Tuesday, "We will work with the landlord so they can find another tenant for this space." City officials have said they don't know whether there's a non-compete clause and do not have access to the lease agreement. Since Hy-Vee's announcement, some residents have voiced support for stores like Aldi to fill the grocery gap Hy-Vee will leave with its departure. Local nonprofit Advocates for Social Justice is calling for people to boycott Hy-Vee for what the group calls a classist and racist pattern of disinvesting in marginalized communities and creating food deserts. Meanwhile, Aldi has made headlines for cutting prices on select items this summer to help customers save money as inflation has driven prices up. Cedar Rapids City Council member Ashley Van Orney has posted on social media to gauge community interest in recruiting Aldi. She posted Tuesday on X that she's all in for welcoming another Aldi to Cedar Rapids. Aldi commented that it had three other Cedar Rapids locations at 1860 Edgewood Road Southwest, 5425 Blair's Forest Boulevard Northeast, and 180 Collins Road Northeast, and asked, "You want a fourth?" Aldi did not respond to a request for comment on whether it is exploring another Cedar Rapids location in the area around the First Avenue Hy-Vee, or whether the company has had discussions with city officials about adding a store. While the city and other community stakeholders explore options to meet residents' grocery and pharmacy needs, Linn County is asking Hy-Vee to engage in collaborative dialogue with the community to find solutions or a way to stay in the location. The Linn County Board of Supervisors on Wednesday unanimously approved a letter asking Hy-Vee to reconsider the store's closure and emphasizing the social consequences of shuttering the store. Linn County's General Assistance Program, which provides temporary services and supports for qualifying individuals and families experiencing a financial crisis, serves residents in this neighborhood who will be disproportionately impacted with few alternatives, according to the letter. "We recognize that Hy-Vee faces the challenging task of balancing business decisions to remain competitive in the marketplace with its social responsibilities," the letter states. "This decision to close, however, will destabilize an already socially and economically sensitive neighborhood. The ripple effect of having fewer options to access basic food needs will be seismic and immediate. Supervisor Ben Rogers, who wrote the letter, and is part of a city work group advocating for short and long-term solutions to Hy-Vee's closure, said his goal was to spur discussion about where the nonprofit sector and local governments can assist in filling the grocery and pharmacy gap. Not all residents can afford food delivery when the store closes, so he urged Hy-Vee to be a two-way community partner in discussions about how to proceed. Funding will be a key issue, Rogers said, but he hopes local governments can work with the state to understand the short and long-term effects of Hy-Vee closures. Other communities, including Waterloo and Davenport, also are losing Hy-Vee stores in socially vulnerable neighborhoods. Supervisor Louis Zumbach, the board's lone Republican, said he normally would not support such a letter but felt it was not political and can open dialogue about the root issues behind Hy-Vee being among businesses to close in the First Avenue East area. "It's a bigger issue than most of us really comprehend," Zumbach said. "I do feel really bad for the people who have used this place for a long time." Supervisor Kirsten Running Marquardt said she wants the county to be part of the solution as the property hopefully transitions to another grocery and or pharmacy use. "It really impacts this critical neighborhood, but it truly impacts the entire county, and it impacts our entire community," she said. In addition to addressing residents' immediate needs resulting from Hy-Vee's closure, the city this week launched its process of drafting a First Avenue East micro plan. It's intended to help the city understand barriers to private development and how the city can alleviate them. The plan area spans from 12th Street Southeast and Coe Road Northeast in the west to 17th Street Southeast in the east and 2nd Avenue Southeast in the south to A Avenue Northeast in the north. The city will study existing conditions this spring, conduct stakeholder engagement over the summer, then share the draft plan and final plan this fall. "We do have an immediate crisis, but we also need to look long-term at what this area looks like. What can we provide long-term to support the community?" said Councilmember Ann Poe, chair of the Development Committee. The final front page story today by Alejandro Rojas, $30 million bond to aid parks and trails goes to the voters. In Iowa City, 16 years after Johnson County voters approved a $20 million bond to fund conservation projects, the first referendum of its kind in the state, voters will be asked to approve a new bond, this time for $30 million to protect water quality and natural areas and acquire land for parks and trails. The Johnson County Board of Supervisors on Wednesday approved language for the referendum, which will be on the November 5 ballot. It needs 60% approval from voters to pass. The goal of the referendum is to raise money that could be used by the Johnson County Conservation Board to buy and develop land. Leading the efforts to support the bond is a committee called Our Land, Our Water, Our Future. Committee co-chair Joshua Schaumburger, president of Think Iowa City, attended the supervisors' meeting and said the committee has anticipated what will be the most asked question leading to the November vote. What will it cost? "Our committee estimates that the passing of this bond with the maximum price tax increase would be $5 for every $100,000 of assessed value. But in many years, there would be little to no increase over the current rates because of the way the bonds will be borrowed," Schaumburger told the supervisors. "And then trails and parks, rivers and embankments, and forests will be secured." Pat Hyden, the other committee co-chair and a former Johnson County supervisor, said the group had discussed at length the cost of the bond, wanting to ensure there would be enough money to do all the work they wanted to do, but also keep the burden on taxpayers as low as possible. "We were concerned about property taxes and were very aware of what those increases may be," she said. "In 2008, it was $20 million, but we're in 2024 now, and so we've got to really look at increasing at least by $10 million, up to $30 million. Thinking that cost of living and all of that, what does that equate to in real dollars 15, 16, 17 years later? She added that the committee came to a consensus on $30 million quickly. After calculating the impact on property taxes, she said the committee felt comfortable with its decision. The $20 million bond passed in 2008 with 61% approval from voters. In the years since its passage, its funds have been used to acquire 1,167.7 acres of land for public use, created 9.2 miles of hard surface trails, and contributed to 15 projects. The funds also have been used to leverage $17.1 million in additional money through grants, donations, and revenues. Some of the projects that received funding from the 2008 bond include the Peckman Creek Delta, Clear Creek Trail, Kent Park Improvements, Hoover Trail, Melinda Reef Riley Fen and Prairie, and the Sutliff Bridge Access, the committee reported on Wednesday. A more recent project was the county's purchase of Two Horse Farm in Solon in 2022 for $1.2 million. The county acquired 83 acres of woodland, prairie, and a farmstead that would be made for public use. Brad Friedhoff, Johnson County Conservation Program Manager, was at a news conference organized by the committee Wednesday afternoon. He said the importance of the work that has been done extends beyond just preserving nature. The areas that were acquired and maintained under the 2008 bond became popular for people who enjoy the outdoors, something he said became especially important during and after the pandemic. When we saw the impacts that those projects had, those public areas had on people trying to survive through COVID, with needing to get out and have physical activities, we really found that those projects we were able to complete with the 2008 conservation bond were very important, Friedhoff said. Wednesday's news conference was attended by members of Our Land, Our Water, Our Future. They were joined by representatives from Johnson County cities and some county supervisors. Hyden spoke about the environmental work accomplished through the 2008 bond and the economic benefits the projects had on Johnson County communities. She pointed to the creation of a trail connecting Solon to Cedar Rapids as an example. She called this new bond a generational investment. "We want to build on this solid and impressive foundation for all Johnson County, for future generations through our land or water in our future," Hyden said. Friedhoff said he sees the new referendum as a continuation of the 2008 bond. "This time we feel much more confident that the show of work we've accomplished will really sell the public on, oh yeah, we want to continue more of that same work," he said. "These projects are a great example of what we can accomplish and what we hope to accomplish in the future." County Supervisor Board Chairman Rod Sullivan praised the work that was done with the first bond and said it's time to go back to voters to ask for more money to continue the work. "We hear from people all the time that there are areas that they're concerned about having them protected, and the only way to do that is to own it. And that's what this is for," Sullivan said. Turning now to the Insight page, 24-hour Doorman today is titled "Bird Takes a Field Trip to New York." This week, Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd made a strong case against politics in the courtroom by appearing at Donald Trump's New York trial on a trip paid for by her largest campaign donor. There Byrd was in a New York courtroom, behind Trump along with some of his other political allies. She wore a bright red jacket. Couldn't miss her. "What we need to do is get politics out of the courtroom and let President Trump get back on the campaign trail," Byrd said at a news conference during a break in the trial, according to Radio Iowa. "Let the American people decide who the next leader of the free world will be, and politics has absolutely no place in this courtroom or any other." That's the President Trump who has vowed to prosecute his political enemies if elected. So here was Iowa's top state prosecutor in a New York courtroom attacking other state prosecutors for charging Trump with falsifying business documents to cover up an affair with an adult film star and keep voters from finding out about it. In New York City, the financial capital of the world, falsifying business records is frowned upon. Her trip was paid for by the political arm of the Republican Attorneys General Association. The association's RAGA Super PAC donated $2 million to Byrd's campaign during the 2022 cycle. It was unseemly, but we live in unseemly times. Trump's Monday entourage didn't show up because they love the guy. They came to bash the prosecution because Trump cannot. The presumptive Republican presidential nominee is under a gag order, precluding him from ripping the judge, prosecutor, and witnesses. But the Republican politicians were free to grind Trump's axes all they wanted. Maybe Byrd believes New York prosecutors are purely political because she is. You're never more than a few days away from another politically motivated lawsuit joined by Byrd assailing the Biden administration. Environmental protection is among Byrd's favorite targets. This week she signed on to a lawsuit to scrap higher fuel efficiency standards for heavy-duty vehicles. It might push companies to use electrical vehicles that won't need ethanol. To the ramparts. She's joined legal action to stop the Environmental Protection Agency from enforcing tailpipe emissions rules, hopped aboard a lawsuit aimed at EPA coal plant emissions limits, and attacked extending Clean Water Act protections to scores of wetlands. Byrd is among red states suing to stop Title IX sex discrimination protection from covering LGBTQ students. She went after the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives over rules governing pistol braces. She signed on to a letter warning Walgreens and CVS to not send abortion medications by mail and lent Iowa support to a Texas lawsuit seeking to overturn the Food and Drug Administration approval of the abortion drug mifepristone. And, of course, Byrd has stopped using victim compensation fund dollars to pay for emergency contraception for rape victims in Iowa. So Byrd has no compunction about bringing politics into court, so long as it's her brand of politics. But this is what voters wanted when they gave us the Byrd. And that is 24-Hour Doorman. We have one community letter today titled, Cut Delivery Costs for Residents Affected by Hy-Vee Closure. The closing of First Avenue Hy-Vee is causing a significant problem for folks who live in the surrounding neighborhoods. In the May 10 Gazette, it was suggested that those folks go to Hy-Vee aisles online. The delivery service charges are $9.95 with a minimum purchase of $24.95. That's not easy for everyone. As stated in the article, many people in the surrounding area have low incomes, as defined by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That means that many often are on foot and/or may find it hard to get gas money if they do not have a vehicle. I want to suggest that our community reach out to Hy-Vee's corporate office and make the request to lower the cost of food delivery through aisles online and lower the minimum purchase requirement for a 2-mile radius around that store. I was told that the team at customer care will compile comments and feedback and refer it to the decision makers at Hy-Vee to be considered. Any decisions regarding lowering the fees for aisles online for folks would be made by those individuals. Can we do this for our neighbors? Let's make an effort to help each other. Hy-Vee Corporate Office Communications Department can be reached at 515-559-5770. Hy-Vee, Inc. is located at 5820 Westtown Parkway, West Des Moines, Iowa, 50266. And that letter today is signed by Tamara Taylor Hillier from Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, May 16, on IRIS. Now let's turn to today's obituaries, beginning with the short notices. First, in Highlandville, Rick Munson, age 70, died Tuesday, May 14. Helms Funeral Home in Decorah. From Loudon, Lucille W. Horman, 95, died Wednesday, May 15. Chapman Funeral Home, Clarence. And in Waukon, Sarah C. Welsh, age 91, died Monday, May 13. Martin Graw Funeral Home. Turning now to the regular notices, starting in Cedar Rapids, Leland J. Shanka, age 91, of Mesa, Arizona, passed away Friday, May 10th in Phoenix, Arizona. Leland, fondly known as Lee, was the son of Joe and Tilly Shanka, born July 15, 1932 in Cedar Rapids. He graduated from Wilson High School in 1950 and married Frances Simkovitz on June 9, 1951. Lee and Frances celebrated 59 years of marriage. Frances passed away in April of 2011. Celebrating Lee's life in Mesa, Arizona and Cedar Rapids, Iowa will take place Thursday, May 16th at the Queen of Heaven Mortuary in Mesa. An Arizona rosary will be said at 4 p.m. Viewing is 4:30 to 7. On Friday, May 17th, All Saints Church in Mesa, Arizona, funeral mass and luncheon at 10 a.m. On Monday, May 20, Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids will have an Iowa rosary at 3:30 and viewing from 4 to 7. And on Tuesday, May 21st, St. John's Cemetery, Cedar Rapids, burial will take place at 11 a.m. with lunch to follow. Online condolences can be expressed to the family at broshchapel.com. In Cedar Rapids, Teresa Thomas, or Tomas, passed away April 30 at the age of 66. She was born July 23, 1957 in Columbus, Ohio. A celebration of life in honor of Teresa will be held July 21st. It will be an open house 2 to 4 p.m. at Prairie Gardens in Cedar Rapids. She will be deeply missed by all who knew her. Memorials are suggested to Safe Haven of Iowa County. Online condolences are welcome at iowacremation.com. Also in Cedar Rapids, beloved son and brother Eric Brandon Pultz, born April 8, 1979 at the Washington County Hospital in Washington, Iowa, entered heaven into God's arms on Tuesday, May 14, after nearly 45 years of total disability resulting from brain damage associated with spinal meningitis. A celebration of Eric's life will be held at the Rem House, 2620 33rd Avenue Southwest in Cedar Rapids, Sunday, May 19th from 2 to 4. A private graveside service will be held at the Elm Grove Cemetery in Washington, Iowa. The Jones and Eden Funeral Home is assisting the family with arrangements. Online condolences can be sent at jonesfh.com. In Williamsburg, David John Kessens, born January 18, 1947 in Vinton, Iowa, the son of Joseph and Sarah Pauline Mielhau Kessens, graduated from Don Bosco High School in 1965. Dave was united in marriage to Julie Delagardell on December 30, 1967 in Gilbertville. Dave died Tuesday, May 14 at his home at the age of 77. A celebration of life gathering will be Sunday, May 19th from 1 to 5 p.m. at the Isaac Walton League Red Cedar Chapter, 5689 24th Avenue in Vinton. A memorial fund has been established for Essence of Life Hospice. Please direct your donations to Wendy Kirchner, P.O. Box 27, Garrison, Iowa, 52229. Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg is assisting the family. Messages and tributes may be directed to powellfuneralhomes.com. In Gilbert, Arizona, Kenneth Marlin Cook, Jr. It is with a shattered heart that the family of Kenneth Marlin Cook announces his passing April 22nd at the age of 74. A full obituary is available at kencookjr.com. In Cedar Rapids, Patricia Grace Thomas, or Tomas, 89, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Tuesday, May 14th at Bickford of Marion. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, May 17th at Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Celebration of Life service will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, May 18th at Brosh Chapel. Burial will be in Czech National Cemetery. Patricia was born June 18, 1934 in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Joseph and Tilly Lillian Shanka. She graduated from Wilson High School in the class of 1952. Memorials are suggested to the Cedar Valley Humane Society. Online condolences can be left at broschapel.com. In Des Moines, Eileen Margaret Rowett, 99, passed away on May 11 at Valley View Village under hospice care. Family will greet friends from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Friday, May 17, at Hamilton's near Highland Memory Gardens, 121 Northwest 60th Avenue in Des Moines. A memorial service will start at 12 p.m. Burial will take place following at Highland Memory Gardens Cemetery, 1 Northeast 60th Avenue in Des Moines. Please visit hamiltonsfuneralhome.com for a full obituary and to leave a condolence. And in Cedar Rapids, Beverly Marie Welch, age 88, passed away Wednesday, May 8th, surrounded by family at home. Beverly was born November 16, 1935, to Henry and Merle Opperman of Strawberry Point. Beverly married Doran Welch, April 9, 1955, 69 years ago. A visitation will be held on Friday, May 17th at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home from 12 until 1:15, followed by a 1:30 p.m. graveside service at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Turning now to the sports page, high school track and field, Tigers go from scoreless to contender. This story by Jeff Linder. Noelle Steins is a distance runner and a distance driver. 5 mornings a week, she's up at 6:30, out of the house at 7:45. It's a 26-mile drive to school. Ariana Grande makes a good travel companion. I turn up my Bluetooth and drive, Steins said. Her destination from her Calumas residence is Tipton High School. She has made friends here since her transfer late last fall from Calumas Wheatland. Plus, there's an actual track I can run on, she said. Tipton is a running community, a track town, and when the stars align, the high school teams, either girls, boys, or both, rise up. Now for the Tipton girls is one of those times. Olivia and me, we've dropped time, senior Addie Nerum said. Ella has come in and helped. She's a good freshman. Of course, that's not all. As Coach Jill Engels said, Noelle fell out of the sky. The Tigers didn't live up to our potential at the state meet last year, according to Engels, and didn't score a point. With the improvement of Nerum and Edens and the arrival of Steins and Hine, Tipton is projected to score upward of 60 points, which would put the Tigers in the Class 2A title hunt, along with Spirit Lake, Pella Christian, and Van Meter. The state meet begins today at Drake Stadium in Des Moines and runs through Saturday. We're going for a top three trophy, Engels said. We're there for business. As Jill Latham, Engels was a middle distance runner at Olwine High School. She graduated there in 2001, then at Iowa State University. Her time at ISU intersected with Tate Steins and Dawn Steins, now Noelle's parents. Despite massive success, 3 individual state titles in cross country, 4 state gold medals in track, plus a 1A team title last year, Noelle became unhappy at Calumas Wheatland. A change was needed and Tipton was the best option. I knew some of the girls from cross country. I usually warmed up with them before meets, Steins said. They've been very welcoming. I feel like I belong here, and it's uplifting. Engels called Steins a great teammate. When she's done running, she'll circle back to the others. Everything that's been asked of her, she has done. Steins is expected to contend in the 800, 1500, and 3000, and will anchor the Tigers' top-seeded distance medley relay. Nerum and Edens have qualified in 4 events apiece in each of their 4 years. They've hit a new level this spring. Edens is seeded 2nd in the 800. Nerum is number 4 in the 400 hurdles. I love the hurdles, Nerum said. I think they're a lot of fun. People think I'm crazy, but I like a challenge. Hine is likely to go sub-60 in the 400 and pick up some points. And the Edens-Nerum-Hine trio will run with Steins in the distance medley, seated number one, with junior Laura Owen in the 4x100, number one, and with sophomore Zoe Holstein in the 4x400, seated number three. If those seeds pan out, the Tigers will be in the mix Saturday afternoon. We've had a lot of accomplishments. We've won a lot of meets. We've had a lot of fun, Miriam said. Now we want to finish strong. In girls' golf, this story by K.J. Pilcher, Warriors shine in regional. The Warriors were state runners-up a year ago. They earned another shot at a title on Wednesday. Washington has some unfinished business. Washington posted a 318 team score and won the team title at a Class 4A regional at Gardner Golf Course. The Warriors advanced to the state tournament May 23rd and 24th at Otter Creek Golf Course in Ankeny. Been waiting and getting ready, Washington junior Jane Patterson said. Last year we were only predicted to get fifth place at best, so we're ready to kick butt this year. The Warriors' Maya Messinger earned medalist honors, shooting a 75 and winning a card-back tiebreaker against Cedar Rapids Prairie's Kylie Wachtel. Messinger opened the round with three straight bogeys but played consistently well the rest of the way. She kept her concentration and composure after the slow start. A rough start comes with nerves, so staying loose, Messinger said. You have so many opportunities to score and get back to even. It's just staying relaxed and knowing there's a lot of golf left. It's not over after a couple bad holes. Messinger capped a busy and successful 2 days with her second state berth. Messinger and teammate Lily Bell Barker helped Washington's tennis team qualify for state on Tuesday. The multi-sport spring athletes were instrumental Wednesday, with Barker rounding out the Warriors' scores with an 85. The key was getting plenty of rest and hydrating after tennis. Also, just focusing on golf and the next shot. Staying grounded, Messinger said. Headspace is here, playing golf and not focusing on anything else. Just trying to do my best and help our team win. Washington coach Dennis Gettle commended Messinger and Barker for their efforts. This is the second year in a row to do it in both sports. In high school baseball, this story by K.J. Pilcher, Prairie's Burkle has fun as Prairie shuts down City High. Prairie's Reed Burkle balances fun and fierce. The self-described goofball also is a gamer, especially on the mound. We're competing, but we're going to have fun with it, Burkle said. It's a fun environment and a competitive atmosphere. That's how we look at it. I think it helps. Burkle got down to business throwing 6 1/3 innings and earning the win in a Class 4A, number 8 Hawks 4-3 victory over number 3 Iowa City High in the opener of the Mississippi Valley Conference baseball doubleheader Tuesday at Prairie. Three Little Hawk pitchers combined for a no-hitter, helping earn a split with a 4-2 win in the nightcap. Burkle has played Legion ball this spring, but was pleased with his first start of the varsity season. He held City High scoreless through 6, allowing 5 hits and striking out 7. I had the off-speed working, Burkle said. I felt pretty good overall. It's a big challenge. 1 through 9, they have real good hitters. It's exciting and good to come out, compete, and come out on top. Prairie has big shoes to fill with the graduation of All-Stater Maddox Fries, who served as the Hawks' number one starter a year ago. Hawks coach James Nelson said Burkle is capable of filling that role. In sports of area interest today, again, it is the state championship at Drake Stadium in high school track. In boys soccer, sub-state takes place today. In high school baseball, Marion is at Xavier at 7 p.m. Davenport Assumption is at Regina at 7 p.m. Turning to the Things to Do Today column, a speaker, Suicide Prevention, Together We Can Make a Difference, takes place at the St. Ludmilla Church Social Hall tonight from 6:30 to 8 p.m. The speaker is Catherine Shea, a psych nurse practitioner for Veterans Affairs, who also serves as a board member for the Linn County National Alliance of Mental Illness. That event is free. Coming up on Friday at 8 p.m., comedian Howie Mandel will be at the Riverside Casino Event Center, 3184 Highway 22 in Riverside. Cost for that show is $55 to $65. In the Hoopla section, this story is by Dorothy D'Souza Guedes, titled Sattvic Swad Brings the Spice But Little Heat with Its Indian Cuisine. The large warm naan is tender and crispy. Shahi paneer paired with light basmati rice has a spicy depth of flavor without too much heat. The mango lassi is a refreshing, fruity thirst quencher with just the right amount of sweetness. These are just some of the flavors you can experience at Sattvic Swad at New Bow City Market in Cedar Rapids. Owner Neha Kuchal started selling baked goods in 2021 at the Iowa City Farmers Market and was then introduced to New Bow City Market by a friend who gave her a coupon that expired that day. "I was so surprised there was so much creativity," she said. When a spot opened at New Bow in January, Kuchal opened a small restaurant. Many visitors at New Bow City Market aren't familiar with Indian food, and she estimated that only about 20% of her customers, mostly young adults, know about it. "They pass by, and my food smells so good, they're scared to try because they thought it was too spicy," Kuchal said. "When I offered the sampling, they loved it. People love it. They love the food." Sattvic means divine, and swad translates to taste. Divine taste, that word means a lot to me. You can find taste in anything, but the divine taste is like, you know, you feel satisfied and your stomach also will be satisfied, Kuchal said. Divine taste also means no meat, and recipes do not include onion or garlic. No smelly food, she said. Food is spiced with nutmeg, chili, cloves, and black pepper for flavor and a little heat. "I know if the taste needs sweeter, I add cinnamon or nutmeg. If you want spicy, I add black pepper, cloves, and cardamom." She's adapted recipes based on customer comments, such as adding more paneer, Indian cheese, or tomato to a recipe. "Not sure what to order? Ask for a sample. Portions are enough for one hearty appetite or shareable for lunch. Prices range from $8.75 to $14.50 for Shahi paneer. Lunch combos start at $10 and offer a taste of more than one main dish, such as chickpea curry and Shahi paneer with rice and naan. Or try chili paneer with Shahi paneer and naan. The most expensive combo on the menu might be chili paneer, Shahi paneer, chickpea curry, naan and rice, or a vegetable biryani for $17.50. Main course dishes vary, but you can count on shahi and chili paneer served with basmati rice. Ask for subtly spiced vegetable biryani. And there is the naan, a warm flatbread usually baked in a clay oven. Kuchal has adapted the recipe for cooking in a hot pan because her market space can't accommodate an oven. The key to perfect naan is letting the dough rise in a room at the ideal temperature and then holding that temperature before cooking. Much of the food is prepped or cooked in Kuchal's licensed home kitchen in Palo. She cooks family meals separately, but her family asks for the market food. They love it. Kuchal moved to Palo in August 2023 after 15 years in Iowa City. The family had moved to the United States from India in 2007 when her husband took a short-term contract that was prolonged and continued. In addition to her husband, their family includes daughter Kamakshi, who is finishing high school in Iowa City before heading to Columbia in New York this fall, and an 8-year-old son. In brief, if you go, it is Sattvic Swad Indian cuisine located at the New Bow City Market. Hours are 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Wednesday to Saturday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Sunday. They are closed Monday and Tuesday, and you can also find them on Facebook under Sattvic Swad. Also in the Hoopla section, this notice, Cedar Rapids' Downtown Farmers Markets launch May 25. The city's core streets are about to turn into pedestrian shopper's paradise. The 19th annual Cedar Rapids Downtown Farmers Market gets underway on the 25th with 7 more dates through September 21st. The event features entertainment, food, and 200 market vendors selling everything from garden fresh produce to artisan wares, wine, and cheese. Markets run from 7:30 a.m. to noon on May 25th, June 1st, June 15th, July 6th, July 20th, August 3 and 17, and September 21. Footprint is 2nd to 4th Avenues between 2nd and 5th Streets Southeast. The average attendance is 12,000 per week. Those are the daylight markets. The ever-popular Market After Dark will be held from 6:30 to 11 p.m. August 24, featuring 100 varied vendors mixed with lively entertainment. This event brings a festive atmosphere to downtown Cedar Rapids with food, beer, wine, art, entertainment, and creative placemaking displays. Average attendance there is 30 to 50,000. For details, go to cedarrapids.org/economic-alliance-events-downtown-farmers-market. Finishing up with the top weather story by meteorologist Joe Winters, dew point. It's not the heat, it's the humidity, but actually, it's the dew point. Relative humidity, a number reported most often, is relative to a particular temperature. It gives you no indication on how you will feel. For example, the relative humidity can be near 100% in January, but it won't feel humid outside. A better measure is the dew point. As the dew point tops 60 degrees, you'll start to feel the mugginess. On KCRG TV9, you will see the First Alert Storm Team using the muggy meter. This is a measure of how the dew point will make you feel when you go outside. The higher the muggy meter gets, the more your air conditioner is going to run. Stay cool. And today we are looking for a chance of storms, wind out of the southwest from 10 to 20, with a high of 75 and a low of 54. That chance of rain continues through Friday, mostly sunny on Saturday and a return to some rain on Sunday. Cedar Rapids' normal high for today is 71, the normal low is 50. The record high of 90 was set in 1992, and a record low of 31 was set in 1997. Sunset tonight at 8:21 p.m., sunrise tomorrow at 5:44 a.m., gives us 14 hours and 36 minutes of daylight. And we are in the first quarter moon phase, with moonrise at 1:41 and set at 3:07. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a copy of today's reading anytime on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening and have a great, safe day.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.